All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Today is June 17th, 2026. And our top story this morning, it is Fed Day. Not just any Fed Day. This will be Kevin Warsh's first FOMC as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And so this is going to inform how things are going to be for the next couple of years. Now, the Fed is widely expected to do nothing today. And so I don't think that's the story. The story isn't, oh, they left rates unchanged or they're going to cut it. They're going to do nothing. All right. The question is, what is Kevin Warsh going to say? And then what kind of statements, what kind of data is going to be put out by the Fed? Now, keep in mind, against the backdrop of this, Kevin Warsh was put there to cut rates. Right? President Trump did not mince words. He wanted a Fed governor that's going to juice the everything bubble with easy money, which, and he never said this, but make inflation worse, which is the reason behind the K-shaped economy and why everybody's so much broke. He wants more of that. And that's what Warsh is put there to do. That's what Warsh said he was going to do. But that was back when inflation was lower than it is now. That was back when the bigger risk was the job market. That's not such a case right now. The job market still largely sucks. It hasn't gotten much better, but inflation has gotten much worse. Since the start of the Iran war and since the data center build-out went cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, driving up the cost of everything from copper to memory, all of a sudden we've got inflationary pressures all over the economy. And the market is now dead set on the fact that the next move by the Federal Reserve is going to be a hike. And it's like a 60-40 chance that the next move is a hike between now and the end of the year. And the 40 is do nothing. There's like no chance of a cut between now and the end of this year. Now, the other question is, what is Warsh going to say? And what is he going to say about how much he's going to say? Kevin Warsh has been pretty clear in prior statements and his lack of statements since taking the helm that he wants the Fed to say less. It'd be nice if the Fed did less also, but he doesn't want the Fed to forecast as much. He's worried that the Fed kind of gets stuck or that they paint themselves into a corner where they have to do what they said they were going to do, which makes them less nimble. And, you know, when you say you're going to cut, but then you hike, it looks like you're panicking about inflation. It sends the wrong message. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is when the Fed doesn't forecast their actions ahead of time, then it's more of a surprise and the market becomes more volatile when the Fed does act. So this is the trade-off with Kevin Warsh at Fed chair today. I don't really know what he's going to say about that. The rumor has it he's not going to put a dot on the dot plot, the summary of economic projections, where everybody says, where do you think rates are going to be at the end of this year? There may be one dot missing if Warsh just decides he's not going to participate. Maybe that means they're going to do away with the dot plot altogether. We're just going to have to wait and see. And of course, you're going to have a lot more combative press corps now because the Fed press corps, they're always fishing for some soundbite they can use to beat Trump over the head. And of course, they're going to be going right at Warsh today. Expect some very short, non-verbose answers from Kevin Warsh today, like maybe even yes or no answers. He will be quite curt, more curt than Kevin. Also, case in point about the inflationary pressure that Warsh is up against, we've got retail sales came out just a few minutes ago here, plus 6.9% for the month of May. Big increase in retail sales. No, that is not indicative of the strength and resilience of the U.S. consumer, as some in the financial press who forgot to bring their pom-poms to work today are trying to spin it as. Actually, the reason why retail sales were so much higher in May is because gasoline prices are counted in retail sales and everybody's spending more on gas. That's what's going on there. And that is one of the inflationary pressures that Warsh is going to have to deal with as Fed chair. Also, on the subject of gasoline prices, look, there's a lot in the press this morning about this Iran deal. I'm not going to spend too much time on it this morning because we still don't have the outright text of the deal. There are some versions circulating in the press. And then you've got the U.S. and Iranian governments are both saying we're not going to release the text of the deal until after it's signed, which is interesting. That would suggest neither government thinks their people are going to be particularly happy with the deal. From what I've read, it doesn't strike me as a very great deal for the United States, that's for sure. And the other thing from the text versions going around, everything important in the deal, other than the immediate opening of the Strait of Hormuz, everything important in the deal is dependent on 60 days after the signing. Oh, and within 60 days, we're going to settle the nuclear issue, and we're going to have a schedule for giving the Iranians all of this money, unfreezing their assets, lifting their sanctions within 60 days. Like, what the hell happens in 60 days where all of a sudden all of these complete a-holes suddenly agree on something? I don't really get it. I think it's still just as likely that the missiles start flying again. But oil's down here in the mid-70s, so the market seems dead set that the crisis in the Strait is over, at least for 60 days now. Other big news this morning, Microsoft. We've got two big ones from Microsoft in just the last 24 hours. First, yesterday, the story broke that Microsoft has walked away from a $3 billion cloud deal with Oracle. Now, not a lot of details on this Business Insider article. I don't know if it was $3 billion per year or $3 billion total. Not a huge deal, especially not in terms of AI dollars. $3 billion is a drop in the bucket. But it seems like every single day there's another story about a data center getting delayed or some deal falling apart or some company can't get financing or, you know, the canceling an issuance of debt because they couldn't get favorable terms. And Microsoft walking away from a big deal with Oracle, that is just the latest example of that one. Now, supposedly it was over a lack of federal compliance and safety standards with Oracle's cloud infrastructure, these federal requirements that Oracle didn't adhere to, and the engineering and cost to implement that would have been prohibitive. So Oracle balked at that and Microsoft just walked away. Now, the other Microsoft deal going on this morning, or other story, Microsoft is supposedly weighing using DeepSeek for a lower cost version of Copilot. And this is token-based billing and token maxing rearing its ugly head once again. Ever since the big AI frontier labs, OpenAI and Anthropic, changed from an all-you-can-eat buffet to token-based billing where you pay for what you use, AI costs for companies have blown out, right? Plenty of stories about, you know, Uber balking at the cost and Walmart balking at the cost of all the tokens they've been going through. And so now Microsoft has this new version of Copilot coming out. Microsoft has to pay that token-based billing. Microsoft's customers are balking at the cost of Copilot. So Microsoft is doing everything they can to get the cost lower, which includes using DeepSeek. Now, that's interesting because they're using DeepSeek. Remember, the previous story was they're not using Oracle because of compliance and safety standards involved in U.S. government data. Well, how are you going to, in the next breath, you're going to go use DeepSeek now? Is Chinese DeepSeek in compliance with U.S. government data requirements? Hey, I don't know. I'm just pointing out the irony here. But the point is, everybody trying to drive their costs lower and trying to lower prices and the aggressive cuts at OpenAI, these are not things you do during periods of insane demand. It's almost as if the costs got so expensive because the losses were so immense in AI that they're being forced to raise their prices. And once AI prices are forced to sustain themselves and pay for their own operating costs, all of a sudden that demand isn't so insane anymore. It's almost like there was never any underlying value proposition in this whole bubble to begin with. Almost. All right, we also got some more information on that May housing starts data that came out yesterday. Now, we talked about this, a big 15.4% drop in May housing starts, and that was really bad, the lowest since the middle of 2020. But that data gets even worse. And I didn't catch this initially in my coverage of this story yesterday, and my friend Melody Wright pointed some of this stuff out as well. This is a big deal. What happened to multifamily housing starts yesterday was, dare I say it, catastrophic. I don't know what it actually means for the industry as a whole, but we have to talk about that one. Not good. We got some automotive stories as well. BMW is out with a profit warning this morning. They're calling for profit margins as low as 1% now. And they are chalking up most of that due to weakness in China. They also pay lip service to the conflict in the Middle East, but mostly a lack of sales in China. And in response, BMW says they're going to accelerate ongoing cost reduction initiatives. Subtitle, they're probably going to lay off more people. The trouble in the auto space continues. And then we got a quite hilarious story from Ferrari. We talked about the Luce, right? Ferrari's new four-door electric vehicle that everybody was not so excited about when it was released, we'll say. It was a lack Luce response to the Luce. Ferrari is now nudging their clients to buy the Luce, saying if you want to preserve your place in line or if you want to move up on the waiting list to get Ferrari's other cars, well, then you better buy this electric vehicle. Otherwise, you're going to be moving down the list. So when you buy the Luce, apparently you're not actually buying the Luce. You're buying access to the next car. Again, doesn't say a lot of good things about demand for this Ferrari. And last but not least, you've got Yum Brands is selling Pizza Hut to a private equity firm. And it's kind of interesting, this private equity firm that's buying Pizza Hut is they own a gym, and now they're going to own Pizza Hut, and they own this funeral services company where they sell like caskets and urns. So, you know, you can, with the same company, you can get in shape, and then you can get fat on pizza afterwards, and then buy the stuff they need to bury you when you die from it. It really makes a lot of sense. It's a vertical integration going on in the private equity space. At least that's what they tell me. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm so you can come back and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day. Right now, the S&P 500 is still grinding higher, 12.8 points in the green, 0.17% to the upside ahead of the opening bell. The Dow is just barely in negative territory, off by 6 points, or 0.01% in the red, going a whole bunch of nowhere. The NASDAQ, though, grinding higher once again, 191 points, or 0.63% higher, although that is still recovering yesterday's losses. The NASDAQ just slowly ground lower, down 300 points and change yesterday. Maybe it was that Microsoft news that drove it, but it was a slow bleed yesterday for the NASDAQ. Looking over at the DXY, we're a little bit stronger this morning, 0.04% to the upside, 99.60 for the Dixie. Looking at the bond market, we've got not a whole lot going on. A little bit of red on the long end of the yield curve there, 4.923 for the 30-year yield. That's lower by a little more than half a point. The 10-year yield is up almost half a point at 4.425%. The 2-year yield is up a point and a half at 4.062, and the 1-month is essentially unchanged at 3.639. Bitcoin has reversed lower from yesterday, currently $64,930. That's off by about 700 bucks here. Looks like we peaked out around 67,000 on Monday, and we've been grinding a little bit lower here. I think, guys, the bottom is not yet in for this cycle. I think we have several more months of crypto winter ahead of us. And I think we're probably looking at least a four handle before this thing is all said and done. Looking over at the commodities board, we've got spot gold is higher by $5 at $4,336 an ounce here, 0.13% higher. Spot silver is up 11 cents or 0.18% at $70.15. I like the shiny. Silver back above 70 bucks an ounce here. Copper is essentially unchanged this morning. Platinum's lower by 1.1%. Palladium is lower by 0.5%. Crude oil is essentially unchanged here, off by about 60 cents or 0.79%. 76.66 for crude oil. Let's take a look at that oil chart, shall we, here? Again, big drop yesterday. We went from $80 a barrel to as low as 75 and change. We're pretty much still at that level here. The market is buying that this is the end of the crisis here. I mean, you can see pre-crisis, we were at about $63 a barrel, well, about 12 bucks higher than that right now. So we've unwound most of the gains that oil made following the initial attacks here. Before the buildup to the attacks, though, we were trading in the high 50s. So still well above that level. And also keep in mind, guys, even if, you know, we do get this signing ceremony and even if all these belligerents agree to stop shooting at each other, it is going to take several months for the oil market to normalize. They don't just open a valve and it's flowing and everybody drinks. You got to load it on the boats. The boats have to get across the ocean and then they got to unload and then it's got to get back into the inventories. You've got a lot of stockpiles that need to be rebuilt. You've got a lot of tanks that are approaching dangerously low levels. And the oil is still not flowing yet, so the market may be getting a little bit ahead of itself. A lot of optimism baked in here. Also interesting in the commodity space this morning, I saw this one in CNBC. Central banks are bringing gold reserves home as geopolitical risks rise. And I know my gold bugs are going to love this one. More and more central banks are storing gold bullion at home rather than overseas as they expect to buy more of the safe haven asset amid heightened geopolitical tensions. These are among the findings of the World Gold Council's annual Central Bank Gold Reserve Survey. It found that monetary authorities still see gold as a key hedge against inflation, geopolitical shocks, and currency risk, despite a recent pullback in prices during the Iran conflict. Central banks have bought an average of 1,000 tons annually over the past 4 years, double the average over the previous decade, per the survey. Nearly 9 in 10 central banks that responded said they expected global central bank gold reserves to increase over the next year, while 45% expect their own holdings to grow. Only 1% expect reserves to decline. I guess you got to count Canada in there somewhere. The survey conducted between February and May and based on responses from 74 central banks also points to more central banks choosing to hold a larger share of their gold domestically rather than in widely used locations like the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. A total of 9% of respondents said they increased domestic storage over the past 12 months, up from 5% a year earlier. Another 10% said they were diversifying their overseas storage locations compared with just 2% in last year's survey. All right, so those numbers aren't too alarming. 9% of respondents said they increased domestic storage. It still means 91% didn't, but that number is nearly double what it was a year ago. So an increasing number of banks moving their gold closer to home. Analysts say deteriorating geopolitical relations are driving the reassessment. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent freezing of roughly $300 billion in Russian foreign assets heightened concerns about how accessible reserves held abroad would be during periods of political tension. Remember, if you don't hold it, you don't own it, guys. And now let's talk about Kevin Warsh at the Federal Reserve, because I think by the end of the day, a lot of people are going to be talking about Kevin Warsh. Trump picked Warsh to cut rates. His committee is talking about hikes. At his first meeting this week, the new Fed chairman confronts an economic turn that began before he arrived. There is new Fed chair Kevin Warsh, and President Trump who nominated him. Kevin Warsh walks into his first meeting as Federal Reserve chairman this week in an awkward spot. He argued last year for interest rate cuts and was chosen to deliver them. But the conversation at the Fed has shifted the other way toward raising rates, not cutting them. When President Trump picked Warsh in January, the Fed looked headed for lower rates and the cheaper mortgages and loans that come with them. Investors expected several cuts this year on top of three in late 2025, thanks in part to a wobbly job market that left officials worried that higher rates were doing more harm than good. Inflation, meanwhile, looked like it might resume a decline toward the Fed's 2% goal once the effects of tariffs faded. I don't think anybody really thought inflation was going to 2%, but they're talking about it. 4 months later, almost none of that holds. Hiring has picked back up and the inflation is climbing instead of cooling. It's now running above 3%. That hiring that picked back up, I think a lot of that was a temporary shot in the arm, if you will, due to the World Cup. A lot of restaurant and hospitality jobs showed up in that last jobs report. I don't think those are going to be there much longer. And of course, higher inflation, that is obvious. The forces behind the turn weren't the ones the Fed had braced for. The AI build-out once expected to tame inflation by lifting productivity instead looks like a source of it, straining supplies of chips, electricity, and materials to build data centers in a way that smacks of a boom rather than a slump. Soaring tech stocks are adding fuel, leaving investors feeling flush and spending freely. Gee, did they just say that AI didn't lift productivity and instead it was a huge waste of resources? Wow, that's kind of crazy. I wonder who's been saying that for 3.5 years, but I digress. And the war Trump launched in Iran sent gasoline and commodity prices higher. A deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz will ease pressures, but slowly. And the economy that emerges won't be the one that existed before the war. The case for cuts has gone with it. Warsh has long criticized the Fed's reliance on forward guidance, including tools like the dot plot. He could deflate the exercise by declining to submit a projection of his own and could strip such hints from the official statement. Either way, he could cast the changes not as a turn toward higher rates, but as housekeeping for a Fed that he wants to talk less. So that's the big thing. Warsh wants the Fed to talk less. I would like the Fed to do less as well as talk less. But at the very least, we won't have a market that sits here and hangs on every stupid little subtle nuance and the elevation of Jerome Powell's eyebrow when he says something and then trading on that. It'd almost be like the market might actually go do some price discovery of its own besides will the central bank pump my bags or not. But taking a look at the CME's Fed Watch tool here, guys, this is the odds of what interest rates will be at the end of the December FOMC meeting based on interest rate futures. And right now, there's only a roughly 40% chance that the Fed does nothing for the rest of the year, 39.6. You got a 43% chance that they hike once, a 15% chance they hike twice, a 2% chance they hike three times. And that little guy over here, I wouldn't worry about that little guy. either way, guys, it's pretty obvious here based on what the bond market is pricing in that the next move from the Fed will be a hike. Is Kevin Warsh going to admit that reality today? Well, just have to wait and see. And this is one of those data points that's putting that pressure on him. United States retail sales year over year, they increased 6.9% in May of 2026 over the same month in the previous year. That is a big jump in May, and you better believe that is gasoline prices, guys. The prices at the pump went way up, and people spent more money. This is not a story about the strength and resilience of the United States consumer. No, this is people going into debt and tapping their 401ks and IRAs and emergency withdrawals in order to keep gas in their car so they can carry on with their lives. Big jump from 4.9% in April to 6.9% in May. Meanwhile, we got this one yesterday. Microsoft falls 2% on Tuesday. Microsoft reportedly walks away from $3 billion Oracle Cloud deal. Microsoft has abandoned highly anticipated negotiations to lease roughly $3 billion in cloud computing infrastructure from longtime rival Oracle, media reports suggested, exposing the widening cracks in Silicon Valley's frantic race to secure AI hardware. The collapse of the multi-year deal highlights a growing friction point for the world's largest tech companies as the demand for generative AI capabilities outpaces the physical availability of data centers. Industry titans are increasingly forced to negotiate massive infrastructure sharing agreements. I love how every time one of these deals falls apart, these guys in the press are like, this is proof that the demand is insane. No, if the demand was insane, they would be more likely to make a deal paying any price. People are walking away from deals and lowering their prices because the demand is not as insane as it once was. What caused the deal to collapse? The $3 billion deal hit a fatal roadblock over strict federal compliance and safety standards. Business Insider reported, citing people familiar with the matter, Microsoft required that the leased server capacity meet the Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program, or FedRAMP, guidelines, a rigorous standard mandatory for any cloud framework hosting U.S. government data. Oracle's public architecture did not meet the specific FedRAMP metrics required by Microsoft at the time of the negotiations. When Oracle executives balked at the massive engineering overhead and intense development timeline needed to quickly implement the upgrades, Microsoft opted to walk away from the table entirely. So another data center deal, another cloud deal falling apart. And that's only one of two Microsoft stories that broke late yesterday. We also got this one. Microsoft weighs DeepSeek models for lower-cost Copilot. The move could help Microsoft control AI costs as Copilot usage rises. Also, keep in mind, we just talked yesterday about how Microsoft was getting sued for downplaying the costs and overemphasizing the growth in their cloud unit. Now here they are potentially switching to DeepSeek for Copilot. Microsoft is looking at cheaper AI models for Copilot Cowork as usage of the tool grows and costs rise. Axios reported that Microsoft has explored using a version of DeepSeek V4 for a lower cost version of Cowork Copilot. The product is currently powered by models from OpenAI and Anthropic. The move would make sense for Microsoft. Some users are running hundreds of Copilot tasks a week, which helps productivity, but could also push computing costs higher. Charles Lamanna, Microsoft Executive Vice President for Copilot, Agents, and Platform, told Axios that heavy use can make costs rise quickly. Microsoft said it expects to release a lower-cost version of Copilot Cowork in the next several weeks. The company has not yet confirmed which model will power it. The report comes as Microsoft moves more AI tools toward usage-based pricing. That shift gives customers more flexibility and much, much higher bills. But it also puts pressure on Microsoft to manage the cost of running AI services. I love how they talk about how token-based prices gives customers more flexibility. Ask the people at Uber who blew through their entire AI budget for the year by the middle of April if they're feeling more or less flexible than they were in March. Yeah, no, usage-based pricing isn't about flexibility. It's about these large language models that absolutely incinerate capital and lose money on a scale most people can't even get their heads around. And they're running out of options from venture capital and debt to keep bankrolling those losses. So they're being forced to raise their prices to a point where the business can sustain itself. And at those prices, the customers are walking away. That's what this tells us. So almost like the demand was never really insane to begin with. All right, now we got to elaborate a little bit on those May housing starts, because we talked about it yesterday. And the data wasn't bad, but I hadn't realized just how heavy the multifamily component of it really was. And this is from the National Association of Home Builders. May housing starts fall as multifamily construction slows sharply. Housing starts fell sharply in May, driven by steep drop in multifamily construction, while single-family building also slipped amid high interest rates, rising construction costs, and persistent labor shortages. Overall, housing starts decreased 15.4% in May. We talked about that yesterday. That's a big drop to the lowest rate since the peak of COVID hysteria, and adjusted an annual adjusted rate of 1.18 million units. But the May reading of 1.18 million starts is the number of housing units builders would begin if development kept this pace for the next 12 months. Within this overall number, single family starts decreased 1.9% to 882,000 seasonally adjusted. That's down 6.7% compared to May of 2025. But look at this multifamily number. The multifamily sector, which includes apartment buildings and condos, decreased 40.2% to an annualized 295,000 pace and are down 14.2% compared with May of 2025. That is a huge decline, 40.2% in multifamily housing. Apartment buildings and condos absolutely destroyed in the home building segment. And this kind of, you know, throws a monkey wrench into the whole housing supply is why costs are so high. And I've always kind of balked at that number because there's plenty of vacant apartments and vacant houses in the world. The problem is affordability. The problem is nobody is willing to rent these things out at a rate that tenants can afford, where they could still afford their debt service costs. And the Federal Reserve is still making money too easy, still holding trillions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheet, and thus are absorbing those losses at the central bank. That's why these costs won't come down. But they're starting to come down. We got this one from Brian Payne, Revenge of the Tenants. Average concession are at a 10-year high and not coming down anytime soon. This is showing almost 17% of apartments are offering some form of concessions in May, such as, you know, your first month rent free or something like that, something they can use to keep the actual rent price advertised high, keep those comps elevated while making the actual cost to the tenant go down without actually lowering the price. And again, you see these concessions rise before the prices starts to fall. And then my friend Melody Wright chimes in. And why are they offering so many concessions? Because we overbuilt and they are still building. And the big drop in NAHB for multifamily yesterday would suggest that. At the same time, the rage delisters are pivoting to listing for rent instead of listing for sale. And I love this phrase. This is the second time I've heard Melody say this now. The first time was when I did a podcast with her and Danny Franks and George Noble last week. And I remember I wrote it down when she said it. That caught my attention. Rage delisting. It's the phenomenon when people put their house up for sale, and after 3 months, they've gotten no offers. And then in a fit, they just pull it down. Instead of lowering their price like they should, they just take the listing off. And I've seen so many listings come and go over the last year or so where they don't actually lower the price. They just drop it all together. And then, of course, they bring it back 6 months later at a lower price. But she's saying a lot of these rage delisters are now opting to rent instead, which means the landlord space is getting increasingly crowded. That is going to put downward pressure on rents. Thank you very much, Miss Melody, for that one. Now on to the car industry. BMW issues a big profit warning. It once again blames on China. The automaker is plotting a major strategy shift. In other words, they're probably going to lay people off. BMW was the worst performing major European stock on Wednesday after the luxury car maker lowered its profit outlook, citing a downturn in China as well as the impact from the Middle East war. BMW says it now expects its pre-tax profit to fall significantly this year versus a prior expectation of a moderate decline, and for deliveries from the auto segment to slip versus a previous expectation of flat performance. Margins from the automotive segment are expected to be 1 to 3% versus 4 to 6% previously. As low as 1% there. Their margins are getting clobbered. Analysts say the new guidance implies a 3 billion euro reduction to operating profit forecast, or it's about $3.5 billion. BMW shares fell yesterday. of its major German rivals, Mercedes and Audi earner Volkswagen, also shed 2%. BMW put most of the blame on the Chinese auto market, and in particular, non-electric vehicles there. We talked a little bit yesterday about how retail spending consumption in China was really hurting. You can see that with BMW's sales in China. The Chinese consumer is feeling the wealth effect. Their home is worth less, and so they're spending less. That includes on cars. And of course, the competition from cheap Chinese EVs is just destroying BMW as well. The situation has resulted in intensified competition in China and across the Asia-Pacific region, said BMW. Positive sales volume development in Europe and the U.S. cannot offset the decline in sales in China and the Asia-Pacific region. BMW said it will intensify and accelerate its ongoing cost reduction initiatives through further structural and efficiency measures. In other words, they're going to cut more people as the company's capital markets day in September now takes an added importance. And you can see BMW stock down 7.8% this morning. Took a big drop at the open in Europe here. Was down as much as 12%. Did recover a little bit, but now it's heading lower as well. This is priced in euros, by the way, 62.58. And we got another one going on here. Ferrari nudges clients to buy divisive EV and move up the wait list. So, oh, you don't like our Ferrari? Well, if you want our next Ferrari, you better buy this one that everybody hates. That is a bold sales strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them. Ferrari is using orders for its Luce electric car as a loyalty test for wealthy clients, signaling that support for the poorly received model may help preserve access to more desirable cars, people familiar with the matter said. The message that purchasing the $636,000 Ferrari Luce is a stepping stone to other exclusive models has been delivered across parts of Ferrari's collector network, the people said, asking not to be identified. Ferrari has long used this allocation system to give repeat buyers of its standard models priority access to limited editions like the $2.1 million La Ferrari Aperta. It's like a restaurant where it's impossible to get a table, said Max Gerardo, founder of the collector car advisory firm Gerardo & Co., and a former RM Sotheby's auctioneer and motor car specialist. If you go every week, eventually they find you one. With Ferrari, the more you buy, the more you're treated as an important client. The Buy the Luce suggestion follows the four-door car's rocky introduction last month when the company unveiled a design that drew criticism for its smooth lines and rounded edges. Bloomberg spoke with more than half a dozen investors and collectors from Italy to China to gather details about how Ferrari communicated with clients following the Luce's presentation. One buyer said Ferrari made clear to him that taking the car mattered if he wanted to keep his place among top clients. Another collector said the company is signaling to many clients, especially potential new buyers, that access to a future one-off model may first depend on buying the Luce or cheaper entry-level cars. So if they do manage to sell this thing, the only reason they're able to sell it is because people want something else that they're selling. In other words, they're not buying the Luce, they're just buying access to something else. Again, that's a real good way to alienate a loyal customer base is by forcing them to buy a dog-shaped product. Otherwise, you won't let them have your other product. And of course, you can only do that as long as you have a loyal customer base and keep putting out stuff like this, and that won't be a problem. And last but not least, let's talk about Pizza Hut. Diners aren't as into pizza, but private equity is. Long Range Capital will buy Pizza Hut's operations outside mainland China for about $1.5 billion as part of a broader deal. This is a Pizza Hut network that has largely been obliterated by private equity franchisees who did sale leaseback agreements and bankrupted a lot of these restaurants. Yum Brands on Tuesday said it struck a $1.5 billion deal to sell the bulk of the pizza chain's global operations to private equity firm Long Range Capital. Yum China Holdings agreed in a separate deal to acquire Pizza Hut's mainland China business for $1.2 billion. So they're spinning off the China business to a Chinese firm, and then they're selling the rest of it to a private equity firm, Long Range Capital. The sales are the latest in a string of deals in the restaurant sector, which is struggling with declining sales and pressed consumers who have curbed their eating out budgets. Yum, which has operated the 68-year-old Pizza Hut brand since the late 90s, said it would focus on its better-growing Taco Bell and KFC brands. Let's see here. Pizza Hut found a believer in Long Range, whose portfolio includes Gym Chain 24-Hour Fitness and Batesville, a company that makes caskets and cremation urns. Pizza Hut is a beloved global brand with a rich heritage and a loyal customer base that few brands can match, said Bob Berlin, founder and managing partner at Long Range. Funny, I don't know any loyal Pizza Hut customers. Most people I talk to that are really into pizza say Pizza Hut is disgusting, but I digress. The U.S. pizza industry boomed following the COVID-19 pandemic, but growth has stalled since then. U.S. sales among fast food pizza chains fell 0.3% last year compared with 2024 levels, making pizza the only food category to register a decline during the period among 10 tracked by Technomic. So it's a rough time for the pizza industry. And let's just say I'm sure what's going to happen here. We've seen this playbook before, right? A private equity firm buys some old brand name. And what do? They initially load it up with debt. They borrow against the assets. They use that debt to pay themselves a dividend. Right? They call it dividend capitalization or dividend recaps. And then, of course, that debt service cost ends up strangling the franchise, and they eventually go bankrupt. And that's probably what's in for Pizza Hut over the next couple of years. Not a good time to be a Pizza Hut franchisee. And I just want to say thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melon Heads this morning. Don't forget the like button and that subscribe button on the way out. Thank you also to my magnanimous Melon Heads for supporting the channel on Patreon, YouTube, and Buy Me a Coffee. Links down below, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time. Live small and dream big.